Bad Time Fanboy.
And we are here. This is Part-Time Fanboy, and I am Christian Horn, here with Paul Edwards, Corey, and with Corey and Nalene Blake joining us for this episode. A Goyle!
A real Goyle.
A Warmburn. Yeah, and we are here to talk. Corey, why don't you tell the peoples what we're here to talk about? Because this whole thing was your idea, even though I've been hounding you for weeks to watch this movie.
I'm more of an idea man rather than an actual do something. So this is the second time we've done this. This is kind of this is our film sort of film club, I guess. And so my idea was that we go through watching sort of what is generally considered some of the best movies in cinema history, I guess. And the first time we did Citizen Kane, because that's, you know, Citizen Kane. And the second one, I decided to make it The Godfather. And so that's what we're talking about today, is The Godfather, the original, obviously, 1972 movie from Francis Ford Coppola, starring Marlon Brando and Al Pacino.
Yes.
So that's what we're doing.
The movie that is as old as I am.
Oh, wow.
Yes, I was born in 1972, so there you go.
Well, you've held up really well, especially since you've been digitally restored.
I know. They did a really good job with the digital restoration. To get started, you guys, Nalene, had you never seen this either?
I think I'd only seen a few bits and pieces here and there, but not the full thing.
Yeah,
wow.
We literally just finished watching it.
I know you did.
We are fresh.
Wow. Yeah, you guys are super fresh. Like
we're still reading the closing credits.
That is amazing. Well, the closing credits aren't that long, but the restoration credits I think are pretty long. Paul, what about you? You've seen this before, right?
Yeah, I've seen it a lot.
Yeah, me too. I mean, that's the thing, is like when Corey, you know, and I think I did the same thing with Citizen Kane. I was like, my all caps goes on in the email discussion. It's like, what? You've never seen The Godfather? Like, because I grew up in New York and New Jersey, and it was required.
That's like mandatory.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they make you do it at school.
Yeah.
They
basically, hooked up the VCR and took the other cable and injected it into my vein while I was watching it. I mean, you basically, like, The Godfather was just like part of the culture. It was part of everything. Like when you grew up in New York and New Jersey, you know, I mean, without The Godfather, there's like no, you know, there's no Sopranos. There's no, you know what I mean? I mean, it's huge back East, or at least it used to be. I don't know what it's like for kids and teenagers now, but like when I hear that somebody else at my job, who joins us on the podcast every once in a while, I had never seen The Godfather either. And I almost fell out of my chair at work. You know, it's like, what? So I was just astounded, you know, especially since you are an actor, Corey, like to not have seen The Godfather. I was just blown away.
There's a lot of big stuff I've never seen.
Yeah, yeah. The only regret is that I wish I had been there with you guys in the room to watch it. It's like that sort of thing. For me, you know, it's like, it's the sort of thing like when I was younger where people have been like, oh, I've never been to New York. And then I would like go on a trip with a friend, you know, who had never been to New York. And I'd be like so excited because I'm like, I'm going to show you New York. Like, I feel like I wish I could have been there. It's like, that's how quit, like.
And then you do a dance number.
Yeah, exactly. New York, New York. Da, 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 you know, that whole
New
thing.
York, New York. It's a wonderful town.
Yeah, exactly.
I've not had the batteries down yet.
Exactly. It's just so part of the culture back home, or at least when I was growing up. So, I mean, let's get started, Corey. What did you guys think? Because this is your first time. It's like you basically walked out of the theater, like the doors open and the sunlight comes and you're kind of blinded and shocked by the whole 3-hour extravaganza. What did
and
you guys think?
And you're handed a questionnaire that says, what did you think?
Yeah, exactly. This is sort of like your test screening. Your chance to give Mr. Coppola notes, as it were.
I found Act 3 lacking, and I go back to the editing bay. I really liked it. Whenever I watch movies, I think maybe the 70s may be my favorite decade as far as movie making.
Yeah.
Because of the, maybe more so the early 70s, but I just love the pacing of it and the attention to the character arc of Michael particularly, and the choices with just the color palette and the way it's shot and the music and the way, like, one thing I miss for modern movies, what I miss for in relation to older movies is the restraint or the ability to not have any sound, to just let there be silence.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That does not happen in movies nowadays. It's like almost illegal.
Yeah. It rarely ever happens. What about you, Nalene? What were some of your first thoughts?
Oh, meh. No.
What?
No. Actually the opposite of that.
She's going to sleep with the fishes.
Wow.
Yeah.
No. One big wow.
Yeah.
Production wise, wow. My goodness, I could go on for 3 hours probably, all every shot. And that's unheard of these days too. I know I saw bits and pieces because I remember in lighting class in college. I mean, I'm so big on lighting, and I was brought up that way. I was taught that way. So. The lighting is just incredible in almost every shot. And to think they shot that with film.
Yeah.
And I know it's been restored, but still film. And I loved the character study, and I loved, honestly, I think it may have been a little bit too long, but
really?
It didn't really bother me that it was a little bit long. You know what I mean? I didn't go, any time now.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think the story arc was incredible, and I really did. I mean, wow, Al Pacino. Huh.
Yeah.
He's kind of a good actor. yeah, Marlon Brando, I just keep thinking about those cheeks and how his jaw was and how much he must have been hurting when he talked.
Yeah.
And, I'm still kind of processing, and I just love the contrast of, look at their big parties and it's so bright.
Oh my god.
Yay.
Yeah.
And then like so dark and shadowy, and then Kay is wearing red and everybody else is in black and white, and like the use of filters in almost every setting, and yeah, it was a lot. It was very compelling.
Yeah, it's a lot to take in, isn't it? I mean, it's a really it's really dense and really powerful movie. What about you, Paul? What are some of your thoughts?
I mean,
because just to let everyone know, we all watched this like this weekend to prep. This isn't like we watched it like 5 years ago. And, this weekend we pretty much just went back and watched the movie. So yeah. What are some of your thoughts?
Then I went and watched a whole bunch of stuff, interviews, and read about pretty much Gordon Willis. Is the guy who invented modern cinematography in this movie. Or sort of rewrote the rules for it.
Recently passed away, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. He just recently passed away, and I had to go. I mean, I immediately had to go and read again. All of his pretty much anything that I could find about it, because I was just like, wow. I mean, it's one of those things that you remember it being good.
Yeah.
But then when you watch it, it's just like, wow, it's better than I remembered it,
Yeah.
It's fantastic. The lighting, that Nalene talked about is just, it's stunning, because, it's something that, in the beginning of the movie, it's quite famous because, everyone's eyes are shadowed. It's lit from overhead. You can't see their eyes, so you really don't know anything about their motivations, and as the story goes along, their eyes slowly get revealed, and it's just a perfect visual metaphor for everything, sort of falling into place. And I it's something I didn't realize, this is that was sort of an accident, you know, they happened upon that lighting style during one of the rehearsals. And, you know, when, as soon as he saw it, it's like, yeah, that's it. That's what I want to do. They were having trouble with actually the lighting because of the Brando's makeup. You know, it just wasn't reading right. And then, like, I think he said it was like the third rehearsal that came about. And, you know, as soon as that clicked in, you know, like everything really started falling into place. You know, they lit things, you know, with studio lights, but they also lit it practically. You know, they lit walls and ceilings and things. They didn't light the people, you know, which is a completely different approach to studio lighting, you know.
Yeah.
There's just a lot of dark shadow in this movie. I understand that it took the actors quite a bit of, you know, it wasn't something they were used to. They were used to being able to move around. And, you know, with this, you know, if they moved a fraction of an inch out of place, they were either out of focus or they were out of lighting. It was a real, I guess that, you know, there was a source of tension even between Coppola and Willis, you know, about the way the thing would end up looking. And, you know, finally, you know, it's really interesting because it's like sort of the birth of Francis Ford Coppola, you know, as an artist, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, he'd made some good movies before, you know, Conversation's a great movie. But like this movie is, you know, just miles beyond anything that, you know, sort of had been done visually up to that point. And, you know, I give a lot of credit to that, to Gordon Willis.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing is, I remember Gordon Willis passed away like earlier this year, and people even saying that, you know, when they were seeing the dailies of, actually the Conversation came after The Godfather, it looks like, on the Internet Movie Database. But
okay.
Yeah. Yeah, but a lot of people were saying that the studio, and I think now you're even saying Coppola himself, like when they were looking at the dailies, were like, what the hell is this? You know, like, what's with all the shadow and what's with all the like darks and everything like that? Like, we can't really tell like what's going on, you know? And,
yeah.
I guess Mr. Willis was like, Mr. Willis, that sounds like different strokes, but Gordon Willis was like, he was like, don't worry about it. It's going to be okay. Just watch. And then, you know, as they went through and kept like looking at dailies and seeing how, you know, editing and putting it together, it kind of like all came together, and people were like seeing like what genius, you know, what a genius he was, you know, because there's a real noir feel to that film, right?
Definitely. Oh yeah, very much.
Yeah, that harkens back to like the 40s and the 50s, right? Which is what it's supposed to do, you know. I mean, it is evoking a lot of those like old gangster movies, you know, that probably Coppola was watching in the theater as he was, you know, becoming a film fan, right?
I mean, it's crime, you know. I mean, it's the perfect, you know, illustration of crime. One of the things I came across that I thought was fascinating was apparently they had to do two separate types of prints for the movie. They had to do a print that could be shown theatrically, and then they had to do a lightened version for the drive-in. They actually had to print it lighter so that it would even show on a drive-in screen.
Wow, that's amazing. That's amazing. Have any of you, like, I mean, I think this movie is amazing from the opening scene. I mean, just that, I'll never forget that, seeing that the very first time, just like even on a, because I think I saw this on VHS the first time when I was like a teenager, and just that scene with the father, and he's like, I believe in America, you know what I mean? He's like, I believe in, and you know, they're pulling back. And have any of you guys ever read the novel, like the actual book that this is based on? Because I started reading it at one point as a teenager, and then I lost it. And I guess I was too lazy or just whatever. I never bothered to track it down again. And the opening scene of the book is almost, it's not the same as the movie, but it's that guy in a courtroom. And at the end of the chapter, it's like, he knew what he had to do. He had to go see Don Corleone. Like there's a lot of, I have not read the book, but it seems to be, especially with Mario Puzo being the co-screenwriter, a pretty faithful adaptation of the novel. Like, And I mean, I was just blown away by that little detail of the opening kind of sticking to the book.
It's much, much better than the novel.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean,
I haven't read it either, so maybe I'm not being fair, but I've heard that the book doesn't really compare to the movie at all.
Interesting.
Wow, I was just expressing interest in wanting to maybe read it, but wow, that's so interesting because you always hear the other way around.
Yeah, yeah.
So much better than the movie.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean,
I did see a note about how when Coppola and, you know, when they were working on the script, that he would just take out pages of the shorts of the story of the book, just write notes on it. You know, that was like his source. You know, he kept this like notebook of torn out pages of the book with all his, you know, notes around it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, just, you know, a little bit of history. Like, obviously, the movie is based on a novel that was kind of like a blockbuster when it came out, right? Like, I mean, Mario Puzo, I guess the novel came out in 1969, like, considered one of the greatest novels of our time. Like, Mario Puzo, who we all also know as having been credited with writing the Superman screenplay, but you know, pretty much was, like, the hottest writer in town. Like when this movie came into development, correct?
That's what I've heard. You know, it's so funny because like I just vaguely remember the Godfather. You know, I'm a couple of years older than you are, and I vaguely remember, you know, hearing about some of that. You know, but really it was like the Godfather 2 when that one opened up that I sort of really remember being aware of the you know, the Godfather itself.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I mean, obviously it wasn't until I was older till I became aware of these movies, but like I said, if you grew up in New York and New Jersey, you knew who Al Pacino was, you know, John Travolta was, you know, who Robert De Niro was, like even
Jimmy Kahn, man.
Kahn, like you didn't as a kid, you didn't know, like, what the big deal was with them. But that was also a period in the 70s, early 80s, where they were just coming out with new movies all the time. Like, you know, I mean, not all the time, but it seemed like they were at the height of their fame, right?
Yeah.
I think so, yeah. It feels like it.
Yeah. And, yeah. I mean, this is the movie that really took Pacino to, like, the height of his career, correct? I mean, this is kind of like his first big movie, correct?
Yeah, I think this is his breakout role, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this was the thing that made him, like, who he was. It looks like he had done The Panic in Needle Park right before that, but that would have been 1971, and then The Godfather. So what about, because to me the most fascinating aspect of this movie is seeing the change in, like, how Al Pacino has changed as far as his acting technique is concerned. Because to
me,
what do you mean? What are you talking about? You know, I mean, honestly, like in this movie, like to me, it's almost like Corey was saying, like this movie, it lets people, it's a different kind of filmmaking that you don't see in big studio pictures anymore. That like there's the opportunity for the camera to sit and watch a character develop, to see what's going on in their face, to watch the subtlety of Al Pacino's like amazing performance. I mean, to me, it's like this is the some of the best work he's ever done on film because he uses his eyes so much. He doesn't talk. There's no gesticulation. There's no like roaring. I mean, it's just he's kind of like being, you know, like what do you guys think?
The only time I saw sort of like that hint of that Al Pacino was when he goes to his sister's, you know, goes to confront the his sister's husband, and he starts to explain and he goes, ah, and he says something like, you know, to just cut him off. But just the way he just kind of went, ah, I don't want to hear it or something like that. And just like vocalization was like, oh, there he is.
Yeah, well, there was definitely some of that always, but I think at this point it's kind of gone out of control, at least like the past 15, 20 years. But to me, to watch this movie, like there's the tragedy of the story that's going on. But for me, as like a former actor, You know, and somebody who studied that stuff, like the biggest tragedy is like, look what you were. Look at how wonderful an actor you were. Look at like what was going on in your eyes and your stance. Like you didn't overdo it. You didn't feel the need to like telegraph your performance for the audience. You let them come to you. And I think that speaks volumes to Francis Coppola's, you know, directing style as well. Right.
Yeah, absolutely. Go ahead.
No, I was thinking also, you know, I mean, literally, again, with the style of movie making that they had, you know, where they had to be restrained in order to stay in focus and to stay in lighting. I mean, you know, that's in a way that sort of bottles that tension and energy that then comes forth on the camera.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a really good point. And also, there's also something to be said for the fact that, you know, everything that you're looking at, they're in that environment. Like, that's a set, or they're on location, or there's stuff happening around them. There's no dependence on, like, probably, you know, CGI or post, you know, CGI trickery.
You're looking at a practical set, you know, like they're there, they're inhabiting that place.
Mm-hmm.
It's in 3D for real.
Yeah. I mean, they're able to inhabit that environment, right? And so that lends a lot to like what's going on. But Corey, you were going to say something a second ago.
Well, yeah, I mean, just as you were talking about sort of the evolution of the character and how Al Pacino portrayed that, it reminded me of another sort of crime an evolution of a evil character that we've watched on TV with Breaking Bad.
Yeah.
And how you know that arc is very much the same. What's that?
Bryan Cranston.
Yeah, Bryan Cranston's the way he handled that evolution of the character, where you know in 3 hours, you know we saw in 3 hours what the Breaking Bad team did in you know what 5 years
five
or seven
seasons. Yeah.
Yeah. Which is not that one is better than the other, but it was interesting to kind of have seen that with having just finished watching Breaking Bad fairly recently.
Yeah. That's a really good point. I suppose that's the nature of sort of tragedy, right? Is a good character who really has no, you know, designs on power or like money or any of that stuff, getting sucked into that world because of power, because of, you know, machinations outside of himself that he can't control, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you're watching him become a villain, essentially.
Yeah. Or you're seeing him get sucked into that world. And a lot of this movie, too, is because of the love of his father, right? I mean,
to say that. Yeah, the loyalty to his dad, when he saw his dad the way he was in the bed, you saw everything change.
Yeah. I mean, I guess we should address the story, right? I mean, does somebody kind of want to try and encapsulate what it's about for, like, the other person in the world, universe, who had not seen The Godfather besides Corey?
Well, I mean, yeah, it's you've really put it sort of in a nutshell there. It is the story of a good man going bad.
Yeah. I mean, it is the story of sort of basically you've got a mob family, right? And the Godfather.
The Corleone family.
The Corleone family. And how you watch the downfall of his father's empire because he refuses to sort of get involved in the narcotics trade because he does not necessarily, he doesn't want to get involved with that because he sees that it's bad news. And, you know, as often happens with business and stuff like that, the new product comes through and you can't really change, you know, what's coming through. And the other mob families sort of start to turn on him. Correct, because he he is the one with the most influence as far as politicians and the police are concerned.
Right. It's the five families is what they call them. You know, there's the different families that are in this organized crime unit, and it basically turns into like a gang war.
Yeah.
You know, where I mean, people are just getting killed in the streets and in restaurants, especially in restaurants, man.
Yeah.
And
never go out to eat.
Yeah.
And you know, and it's, you know, very, very brutal. That's one of the things too about this movie is that, you know, it's one of the first, sort of crime movies that's just ridiculously, you know, violent, you know,
yeah.
Like, you know, the gunshots are, you know, they brought in, you know, practical effects to, you know, make them bleed and actual explosion. I mean, there's that's what's sort of what stands apart from a lot of the other noirs and things that came before it, is that they were fairly bloodless.
Yeah.
You know? And this one, you know, didn't pull any punches.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that Amy and I, my wife, because obviously I watched it with my wife, and when Sonny gets it, which, you know, spoiler, you know, when Sonny gets killed, we kind of looked at each other and we're like, can you imagine 1972 sitting in a movie theater, never, ever, like today it's like, oh, whatever, you know, it's like you see something like that and it just kind of, it doesn't roll off your back, but, you know, it seems like these days, you know, you turn around on TV, you're seeing kind of stuff like that, you know, on basic cable, but like on an episode of The Walking Dead.
It was surprisingly brutal. I mean, you know, and what made it stand out so much for me was how long it went on.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, you got him.
There are some scenes.
How many times did he have to be shot? Exactly.
Sustained brutality. Yeah. You know, Bonnie and Clyde had come out, what, 5 years before this?
Yeah.
And, you know, the ending of that one was widely considered to be like sort of the big, you know, opening for like realistic violence in the movies, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, you had the Wild Bunch, you know, which is like, again, an insanely amazing, violent, you know, Western, you know, just a couple of years before that. This is really, though, the first, as far as I know, the first, you know, gangster movie or first crime movie that really sort of embraced the new violent aesthetic.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and that's the thing. Oh, go ahead, Nalene.
Oh, thanks. What I was going to say, too, was that, yeah, it was violent, but it wasn't in-your-face violent, and I think I really liked that, too. Like, it wasn't like, look at all of the blood and look at... Except for the horse head. But anyway.
But
otherwise, it was like, it would just happened. It didn't need to be like, let's close in on, you know, do a close up on where they were shot and how, you know, all the blood.
That's a good point.
Yeah. It wasn't like completely sensationalized or whatever.
Oh, that's a really good point. I mean, what's really funny, again, like, I just imagine seeing that for the first time and just being holy moly, like, that's just crazy. Like I could see, like, people just being shocked by that sort of thing. And, like, again, Corey, it's really funny. Corey talks about the 70s. You know, you had a lot of movies started to come out because, you know, the studios were kind of flailing at this point, just trying, you know, a couple of them had almost gone bankrupt. I think 20th Century Fox had sold off like a ton of its lot after Cleopatra, you know, had bombed. And so you had like studios, movies were not making money and they didn't know what to do. So they were kind of unleashing these like young film directors and just being like, go do what you're going to do. And a lot of them kind of went like not crazy, but, you know, they were able to sort of embrace their artistic, you know, side and make these beautiful pieces. But at the same time, there was a lot of the new violent content and nudity that you were not seeing in movies at the time.
Yep.
That's true. I was kind of surprised by the nudity in that one scene.
Yeah, I mean.
I think I said, is she going to take him out?
Are we going to see them?
Because otherwise we didn't really see anything like that.
Yeah, so, yeah. No, I mean, the 70s was a really good time of experimentation. I think Paul is right in that this was kind of one of the big studio, because I think the budget on this for the time was really big. And I think that this is one of the big studio pictures that was like throwing open the doors and being like, look, here we go. You know, are you along for the ride?
Supposedly the studio and Coppola really were not getting along, and they were second guessing him just pretty much every step of the way.
Yeah.
And they even had like from what I read online, which must be true, a second director shadowing him in case they were going to fire him. And
That's crazy. I mean,
yeah. And talk about self-conscious.
Yeah, I know. Well, that's the thing is that, you know, again, the Godfather was like a huge novel when it came out. So this must have been a property that, you know, the studio was like, don't mess this up, dude. Don't mess this up. And Coppola, you know, I mean, he kind of has a reputation these days for having been a guy that fought with the studio, but the fight was worth it, right? I mean, he's created some of the best films, you know, ever put to celluloid.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's certainly, you know, the Godfather and, you know, Godfather 2, which I'm honestly, you know, Godfather 2 is one of those rare sequels that, you know, certainly equals, but you know, in my case, I think actually even surpasses the original.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, he's done some spectacular stuff. You know, maybe not so much lately. You know, but you know, Youth Without Youth wasn't bad. You know, I didn't see Twixt yet or anything, but you know, but he's got, yeah, he came out with some pretty amazing things.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he definitely built the foundations for a lot of stuff, in my opinion. I mean, I think he's done some really amazing things. But, you know, just all the, you know, Apocalypse Now, Godfather 2, you know, I mean, that for me just, you know, gives him, you know, a pass for practically like the rest of his life. Yeah. I mean, you know, and just not to mention some of the stuff that he helped produce, like American Graffiti, mm-hmm. You know, and then, you know, it looks like he worked on The Black Stallion, like, I mean, like all these movies, which I've never actually seen that movie, so I don't even know why I called it out. But, you know, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, like, the guy's a freaking genius. I mean, you know, I think the last great movie I saw of Coppola's was, like, The Rainmaker, which had Matt Damon mm-hmm. in it as a lawyer. And that thing surprised the hell out of me. Like, I just remember being like, wow, I don't. Like, I was just, like, not expecting anything from that movie. And then being surprisingly, you know, kind of moved by the whole thing, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, for me, the last one that just really just does it for me from him is Tucker, you know?
Oh, my God. Tucker's, yeah, that's a great movie, too.
Fantastic movie.
And, yeah, yeah.
You know, that's a really good movie. Yeah, and, you know, since then, you know, what's really cool about Coppola too is that he's the guy who's actually done what George Lucas actually threatens to keep doing, you know, which is like George Lucas is like, you know, yeah, I'm going to quit. You know, I'm just going to make, you know, nice little small personal movies, you know, now, but Coppola actually did it, you know, he's making, you know, digital, productions now. I mean, Twixt is a freaking horror movie, for God's sake, you know? Like, who does that? Who does, like, moves from, like, The Godfather to doing, you know, horror movies and things with Val Kilmer and Bruce Dern? But it's, you know, he really does follow his own path. And, you know, it's he's immensely respectable in that sense.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I really found, you know, the one thing that I love about this movie, and it's funny because, Corey, you mentioned stuff that studio movies kind of don't do anymore. Like, I was raised in New York and New Jersey, and there are a lot of Italians in New York and New Jersey. So it's a culture that you were kind of like around a lot, you know, and if you weren't around it, you had like Latin people pretending to be Italian, you know, people just wanted to be Italian. It was a time where you wanted to be Italian. But watching this movie in Los Angeles in 2014, like it really, like I can imagine maybe being in like middle America or Florida or even LA in 1972 and seeing this movie and it giving you like a window to a culture that you would not have gotten like yeah. anyplace else. Like this was not, you know, you would see mobster movies in the 40s and 50s, but none of them were like, I mean, I'm sure there would be like a mention of like somebody being Irish or somebody being like Italian, but you didn't really get like a feel of like how much family meant, which could be universal to a lot of cultures, Polish, Irish, you know, Latino, you know, but there was a sense while I was watching this that really gave me a feel of like, wow, I'm like actually in another world. Like I'm in this culture. I'm kind of fully absorbed in what's happening. And mm-hmm. and that to me just seemed like really impressive. And it doesn't seem like something that, like, we just don't make epics like this anymore. Like, this is like an epic. When was the last one that really was really that great? Can you guys think of one, or a movie that hit like sort of the popular culture that was like even on a level of this, The Godfather?
Well, I think that's why, you know, when you're talking about sort of that cultural experience, why it was so smart for them to start with that wedding.
Yeah.
A wedding is a reflection of the culture. I mean, those customs and traditions that that each culture has at a wedding ceremony is different. And we see two weddings in this, you know, one in the modern day of the movie, when he's in Sicily, and he gets married there in that little village, and so you see both of those, you know, and that kind of immersion, you know, like the first time I ever went to a wedding that was not like you know Anglo-Saxon Christian whatever. You know, it was experience. It was very eye opening. I was like, oh, you do this. You know, like
A
Jewish wedding is very different than a Catholic wedding. You know, so to see that is a great window into that kind of family culture. You know, seeing them sing, seeing like the patriarch. You know, like the older people. You know, they bring the mother over. She sings. You know, and the way they danced and all that stuff is like really unique to that culture. And you're right.
That's really interesting.
In 1972, you're right. You're absolutely right. I bet in like, you know, everywhere else other than New York, that probably was quite a revelation, quite a like eye-opening thing.
Yeah. I mean, it's so funny how much of that has kind of devolved into stereotype or certain elements of this movie. But that was the thing that I was thinking that really kind of made the movie even more beautiful to me. I mean, obviously, I'm sure you would have Italian Americans being like, well, we're not all mobsters and we don't just eat pasta. Like, I remember when The Sopranos first came on, a lot of people were just, you know, kind of like upset as to how many scenes there were where people were eating in the kitchen and feeding each other and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, and that's a legitimate gripe. I would imagine that there probably were Italian Americans. Well, we're not mobsters, you know, and that's true. That is a bit of a detriment when you're speaking about the culture as a whole. But there are elements in there, like the things that really just get to me about this movie are like the aspect of honor and being honest amongst your family and them. You saw that they all really cared for each other. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That there was that as messed up as that life is, that there was a love there, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And you know, I think a lot of the themes and everything that you're talking about, you know, they have survived, but you see it more in television now because you can explore a greater number of characters and things like that. You know, the comparison to Breaking Bad is actually not a bad comparison at all, because I think they are similar sort of noir crime stories, you know. And, you know, that are very character oriented. You know, now Breaking Bad's definitely more, you know, suburban, you know, America. And I think one of the things that's become more interesting is that, like, you don't have, like, the old traditional family structure anymore that you did have.
Yeah.
Like, when the time Godfather came out. I mean, you had families that, you know, that all had lived together in big cities and had never really come apart, you know. The family structure is so much more fragmented now that you're just not going to have that same sort of epic, sprawling, you know, intergenerational story that you can shoot sort of in one place anymore.
Yeah. Oh, that's really interesting. Yeah. I mean, never thought about that.
And speaking of that, you know, that cultural sort of thing, the changes that have happened. I mean, even the role of women, you know, you see in us a number of scenes, Godfather, where, you know, they outright say, you know, the women and, you know, men have to be careful. Women and children can just flail about, you know.
They're careless.
Oh, careless. That's what it was. Yeah, careless.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, the sister, how out of control she is, because obviously she knows she has no power in that family of very powerful men.
Yeah.
And will never inherit that power. And, you know, the mother who is basically, you know, it's like, I think I knew which woman was the woman, was the mother.
Yeah.
You know, like it was, you know, so it's all about, you know, the men. And that obviously has changed. Obviously, you know, in Breaking Bad, you see how the wife in Breaking Bad becomes a more significant role and becomes a more significant role, not only as an actor, but a role in the family and as a as an influence in what the family does.
Oh, yeah, that's a really good point, because, I mean, that is something that I felt while I was watching this movie, is how weak, you know, especially sort of like Diane Keaton, which is really funny because the type of person and actress that she would become after that, you could see that they were trying to really fit her into this, you know, which is part of the story, right? I mean, Michael Corleone, he becomes involved with her because she's so outside of the world that he's from, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that's part of him trying to, and, you know, part of, I guess, what would become like part of his journey to assimilate to sort of like the WASP, you know, Anglo, whatever culture of America, you know, because mm-hmm. that's what everyone kind of was sort of aspiring to in the 50s or whatever, you know, 40s and 50s. So I felt, but it was really interesting to me how sort of weak and muley like Diane Keaton's character was, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I didn't even buy actually when he came back to her finally after, you know, well, my other wife died, so I guess I'll take you back.
Without saying that to her. I wonder if he ever told her.
Yeah.
Probably not.
Probably not, yeah. But yeah, I that's probably the one character choice of the movie that I didn't buy was her like saying, okay, I'll just get in the car and that's it.
You know, that's really funny because I kind of did buy it. At first I was like you, but then I did because it's a different time. Like,
yeah,
I really felt like the 50s and the 60s, especially like listening to people like from our parents' generation or my mom's generation or even older, that it's just like, well, you know, if he's a nice man, I guess this is what I'll do. You know what I mean? Like, I think that a lot of women maybe back then, and, you know, she's a school teacher, yeah, and you always see like, you always see like in old movies or TV shows, it's like, you're getting a little long in the tooth, honey. You might want to get married. So I feel like for some reason,
it's a decision that made sense for her, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a practical decision.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It seemed like it was the only option she had just because we had no other indication of her life outside of him.
Sure, right. Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, if you wanted to make a movie out of her character, sure, that would be great. But right. Obviously she's not, like, the central character. But it's funny because what you're saying is, I totally agree with you that might be sort of the one shortcoming of this movie, is that there's no really powerful female character in the whole thing. But at the same time, you're sort of living in a time where a lot of women didn't have power, mm-hmm. right?
I mean, and certainly you're in a culture, you know, there where, you know, I mean, in that crime culture, anyway, not necessarily the family structure, but certainly in the crime organization, that, you know, that's just not going to happen.
Yeah, yeah, I guess definitely. And, you know, unfortunately, still to this day, there's still cultures or however, you know, that see women that way, which is like ridiculous. But yeah, what did you think, Nalene, while you were watching it, because you're the woman in the room?
Oh, watching the women,
Watching the movie as a whole, like,
it very much reminded me of what I've learned that the 40s and 50s are like, men are in charge. It also reminded me of the mob movies and TV shows I've seen where, you know, I mean, the women don't have a say, and if they ask, how dare they? Uh-huh. And I do like that she was like, no, really, tell me. She did stand up a little bit at the end. But what I was just thinking about while you guys were talking too, wasn't listening, no, was that she wore red. But guess what? By the end, she was not wearing red. She was wearing like that, like, tan, brownish color.
Yeah.
Was assimilating completely with the family. But maybe a little bit differently, though, because she was where it was not like a black and white gray sort of image, but it was like,
it's like the last of her color.
It was like the last of her color. Oh, I like that. She was losing part of herself when she found that out.
Yeah. Whatever. Well, isn't that because that final shot, like at the end of the movie, is like one of my favorite moments in it, because the whole movie's about Michael. But when they close that door and they focus on her. She's like the last shot in the movie.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
She is the last shot. And for a second, it made me go, wait a minute. Was I just watching a movie about her? Like, was there something that I missed? Like because it seems like, well, like...
Yeah. She did try to take over a little bit. She kept trying to reach him, to find him, to get him to come back, to get him to say where he was going. She made her way into their, you know, into their whatever property.
Yeah.
She really did push. She tried. It just didn't work out that way, basically.
Well, I think she was his last remnants of, you know, or she represented his last remnants of, you know,
the normal life.
Yeah, the normal life, being the angel, not angelic, but I mean, but yeah, being a heroic figure or being a traditional. Yeah, exactly. And
it's
and
funny
then,
that, yeah, I mean, absolutely. I totally buy that. Yeah.
But do you guys, I just had a thought, like, do you guys think that she's representative of the audience? Like, because like while we're watching this movie, I mean, basically you and I would assume, I don't know, are you guys killing people and dumping them in the river, are moral people. Like, we go into this movie, you would think, like, if you're going into this movie fresh, I'm going into this movie, I kind of know what I'm going, and as you're watching the movie, you get sucked in. Yeah. You start to love these characters that are basically, yeah, like, killers.
Yeah, I have, like, to say, I wouldn't put it, the killing people and dumping the bodies in the river, I wouldn't put it past Cleo, but...
Cleo.
Cleo is Corey and Nullian's cat.
I think she's definitely the audience stand-in. I mean, like the whole, I mean, you know, that fit the famous line, you know, he made him an offer he couldn't refuse. It's delivered, you know, to the audience stand-in there. You know, I mean, there's, I agree.
So many times.
Yeah, in that wedding scene, he, you know, she is told, you know, the exposition is given to her. You know, Michael gives all the background and fills us in. It's, which is kind of, you know, while I was watching that, I was like, has he never spoken of his family? Like, is this their second date? But,
you
know.
It might have been. It was the 40s and 50s. Yeah. I mean, it
could have been.
Well, also, I mean.
Know him.
Yeah.
She might have started to get to know him. But I also think that maybe certain subjects you kind of didn't talk about back then. Like, you know what I mean? It's not like, my dad's a drunk and what a jerk. You know what I mean? Like, I think that there were certain subjects during a certain time where, you didn't talk about, like, I've heard people talk about, you know, people in, like, my father-in-law's generation where it's like, you don't talk about religion. You don't talk about, you know, politics. Like, that's You just don't talk about that. And maybe family's in there, too. Like, you don't talk smack about your family.
Plus, he obviously felt, you know, he probably felt a little embarrassed about it, you know, and awkward about it and didn't want to talk about it.
Yeah. Sure, sure.
It's hard to bring up, you know, hey, my family's in the crime business. You know?
mumble.
It's cool that you were talking about, like, how, you know, the color palette changed, too, because, like, one of the famous things in The Godfather is the oranges. The orange symbolism, you know, that basically anytime something bad's going to happen, it's, you know, there's oranges involved. You know, the first time Sal is there, you know, he's got an orange, you know, there's a bowl of oranges in front of the dude with the horse, you know, right before he's shot, you know, Don Corleone buys oranges. It's really funny that it's like becomes like the symbol of violence. And from what I've heard them talking about, they picked it just because they wanted some color in this very dark movie. And the oranges just provided like a nice bit of color.
Huh. You know?
And so they started putting them in all of these scenes and they end up sort of taking on a symbolism of their own throughout the movie, because pretty much anytime something bad's going to go down, just watch. They're oranges in the shot.
Now I want to see it again.
That's
never
interesting.
Eat an orange again.
Because there's a scene, because Amy and I love this so much that we watched the second one, which is a 3.5-hour movie, by the way. But we watched the second one, and there's a couple of scenes with oranges in that one, too.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, oh, wow. I'd never really heard about that. That's interesting. So, I mean, before we get to the end of the hour, what are some of the moments that kind of stand out? Because we didn't really talk about the full arc, but, like, what were some of your favorite, like, I would say crazy moments, because the ones that I'm like, whoa, what happened? But like, what were some of the standout bits for you guys?
Well, the horse head is iconic.
Yeah. yeah.
We haven't really talked about that. And that's one of those scenes where it's like, I
knew.
Did you
know
about,
that was coming?
Yeah, I knew it was going to be in the movie. I knew there was a horse head in the bed of this movie, but I didn't know when. But I kind of figured that there was going to be that guy, but I didn't. And the movie that I, you know, like whenever I think of that scene, I think of, I think it was Airplane or Airplane 2 maybe, where there's a, you know, he just, you know, the wife rolls over on the bed and there's a horse head in the bed, but it's just like, they're just like sleeping together and the horse gets out of the bed.
Oh,
but so obviously this is the first time I'd seen it in, you know, the actual original version, and I didn't know that it was, you know, somehow put in the bottom of the bed, and the fact that it was his horse. It wasn't just like some random horse. It was like, yeah, you know, this was obviously a prized possession. He really loved this horse, and so that really kind of made it. It kind of compounded it. You know, like it wasn't just like, oh, here's a random horse.
It was
ours.
Yep. Obviously, the baptism scene is like, it's sort of like the masterpiece of American cinema. I mean, it's a perfectly edited, timed, scored piece of cinema. I mean, like literally, like everything about that scene is just perfect. You know, and that's about like a 5 minute segment there, you know, where basically he's consolidating the power, you know, by having the heads of the five families whacked, and you know, while at the same time, you know, he's doing the vows, renouncing Satan and promising to be true. I mean, it
juxtaposition there.
It just kills every time. I mean, that, like, you know, even if he had, if that had been the only thing Coppola had ever put together, like, he'd still be a genius, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that scene too, you know, going back to Pacino's acting. I mean, the intensity on his face, like, while, like, it's like, wow, like, this is the juxtaposition of images, but it's like, this is like kind of, this is it. Like, he's become like what he totally did not want to become. Like, he's been swallowed whole. Like, that, that is just so incredibly powerful, just his sort of performance in that scene, you know. And there's no bellowing and yelling. He's just like, you know, being in that moment, you know. And do you guys think, like, I've always wondered, is he thinking about what's going on in that, or is it just, you think he thinks what's, while he's taking those vows or whatever, he's thinking about what's happening?
Yeah, I felt like he wasn't even really paying attention to the baptism. He was so busy thinking about what was going on and taking that whole world on his shoulders. Like, I felt,
that's interesting,
like he felt like a different person to me than the beginning. I would love to do like a, you know, a scene to scene sort of thing, like where he first shows up at the wedding compared to there. Like,
yeah,
really watch his face.
He definitely becomes harder as the movie goes on. And it's really funny, because one of my favorite moments, you know, in the movie is when he rescues his dad. Like, because that's the moment where, like, okay, he's in. Like, this is it. Like, there's no escaping. And he's in because he's doing it to save his father's life, not because he wants to, you know, because it's at that point where he's like, okay, I'm getting involved in the activities where I've never had, I've never wanted to before, you know, but it's because of necessity to save his father's life, not because of choice, you know, because if he doesn't do anything, his dad's dead.
Yeah, right. when he says, "I'm with you, Dad," it's like, oh, that's it. That's
it. Like, that's the moment that, and then from then on, it just, that's when the train starts going, because when he gets taken out, you know, into the, and then the policeman like punches him, and you see the look on Pacino's face, like, you're like, oh, it's just so, like, it's so heartbreaking. It's just like, this is it. Like, this is it.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Like, this is where you're going down the rabbit hole. And there's this is where you begin to see the transformation of a person, you know.
And I think it's genius.
You know what's
too,
weird,
that,
though?
Yeah, like, at the end, real quick, nine. But just the fact that you can even, what, how many years after this movie, ask the question, do you think he's thinking about that in regards to the baptism scene? You know, I mean, it's such a, like a sifter, you know, it's so well made, but you really don't know for sure at the end of that scene. And that's what's so, that's one of the things so great about it. Sorry to interrupt. Yeah.
Oh, that's okay. No. Because I do think it was gray. I could see it in numerous ways, but that's what I felt like, especially as I saw what was really going on, you know, because while you're like, what's happening? I feel like, what if he actually turned a corner when he was telling Kay at the wedding that about that story? I felt like he suddenly owned that story and owned the family a little bit. Like, I felt like because he seemed a little bit like he was turning away from it every time she asked or whatever. But when he told the story, he seemed to settle in a little bit.
About Luca Brotz, I think, is that?
Yeah,
right?
I think that's what it was. Yeah.
Yeah.
When he started to get really real about what his dad did or whatever happened.
Yeah.
I feel like he kind of let down his guard a little bit, sat down a little bit, you know, more comfy in his chair or something. And it just changed a little bit just because he was in contact with his family. I mean, wasn't that the big thing? You know, his dad was like, where's Michael? I can't do the shot without Michael.
Yeah.
So early in the movie about all about Michael.
That's true. That's true. That's true. He can't do they couldn't take the picture without Michael. I mean, that's sort of the thing of, you know, you get the feeling like that's why he joined the army, to get away from his family, because like he wanted to be something different. It wasn't just that because part of it is that his dad wanted him to be something outside of that crime family, right?
Right.
I mean,
that's the feeling that I got. So
or a politician, so that he could help, you know, pull.
That's true.
Yeah,
that's true.
Which
is
great. That conversation he has with Kay in the street, where she's like, "I'm not naive. Politicians don't."
Basically,
and you're like, really?
They were so not jaded in
conversation ever.
Well, I mean, obviously, and that conversation takes place like what, during the Eisenhower administration, like the 50s or something, you know? I mean, you definitely had this like, well, they don't assassinate people. And like, we're sitting in the modern day and we're like, that's pretty much all they do, right? it's so funny. Like, what's really interesting, and if you want to just go even deeper for a sec, it's totally how that mob mentality has kind of taken over politics in general. Like, you know, it's like pay for play, you know what I mean? I mean, where they were, and you see a bit more of this in the second movie, where you see Don Corleone's original rise to power, you know, and you guys should see the second movie. I mean, you're gonna have to break it up over three nights, but it is it is just as powerful, if not more, than the first movie. But you know, you see this sort of thing of like they are sort of fending for their own in a society that kind of doesn't look out for them. You know, the whole immigrant population thing, where in the, you know, early 20th century, you know, where it's just like you're on your own. You sort of had a community, but the police weren't looking out for you because they were all corrupt. And, you know, the other business owners couldn't look out for you because they were all corrupt. Like, you're basically surrounded by corruption. And the only way to survive is to become corrupt yourself. You know, not that that's an excuse, but, you know, it's really funny how it seems to me like it's like when we on Facebook or whatever, you see people commenting about politics, and it's definitely becoming, you know, corporations, money. Like, it just seems like it's all become like that's all come out into the light, whereas before in the Godfather era, you know, they were still hiding in the shadows, but they were still controlling stuff. It's kind of interesting. I don't know, but all in all, I mean, how did you guys, Corey and Nalene, do you think like this movie lives up to its stature? I mean, do you think it lives up to, you know, the sort of love that it's gotten by film buffs, or do you think it's a bit overrated?
Oh, I think it lives up to it. I'm actually pleasantly, I don't know if surprised is not the word, but I feel, you know, satisfied about it. I was, you know, I've always been a little bit unsure just because I've seen bits and pieces, but you have to see it from beginning to end to really appreciate what you're watching.
Yeah.
I think what I was relieved about is, yeah, it's you know, one concern I always had was, is it going to be just glamorizing crime? And
yeah.
I don't think it does. I think it just tells a human, you know, it's like a human story of a of a family. And, you know, essentially, it's essentially the fall of grace, of this son. And
yeah.
Him sucked into this world. I don't think it's like, oh, happy ending. Yay, he's with the family. You know, it's like, it's a pretty tragic ending where she, you know, where she's like, it wasn't you, was it? And he was like, nah, it wasn't me. And she's like, oh,
yeah.
God. And then she leaves and then looks back. And then the way he's, you know, people are kissing his hand, it's like, becomes very clear that, yeah, it was him. And, you know, like,
except
that's
it
pretty
wasn't.
Dark.
Yeah, yeah.
It's whatever he's
wow.
got, the
Loophole,
guy was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Loophole wasn't me.
But I wasn't in the car.
Yeah.
Blah,
yeah.
Blah, blah.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. For me, you know, it's always hard because, like I said, I grew up in an area where, you know, the movie was lionized, basically, you know. And, but, you know, watching it now, I don't think I've seen it probably at least for 15 years. Like, or seen the whole thing, like sat down and watched the whole thing. And I just think it's staggering. I think it's amazing. And once you guys get to the second one and we watched the whole thing like back to back to back, like the whole Labor Day weekend was basically Godfather 1 and 2. Like, so I'm ready to go out and, you know, cut some horses' heads off.
And,
like, no.
And by the way, you can just stop there too.
Yeah, exactly.
You don't have to do the third one.
I always
yeah.
heard that, but I'm still
is
curious.
Is there nothing redeeming about it?
There is. That is the thing.
Gordon Willis did shoot it. So, I mean, it's pretty.
The story of Godfather 3 is like a giant mess from what I know. And the thing is that apparently Coppola signed on to do it, and they had a release date for Christmas. And, you know, much like Coppola, he kind of was running over. Winona Ryder apparently supposedly got quote unquote sick, couldn't do the movie. And then his daughter steps in. And apparently, you know, Coppola was saying like he couldn't finish it by Christmas. But the studio was like, buddy, you got to get this out by Christmas. So like Godfather 3, I'm very curious to see it now because the structure of Godfather 2 and 1 are very similar. Like, there's a lot of similarity in the structure, like the opening scene, the closing scene, a lot of interesting stuff in between. The genius of The Godfather 2 is that they were like, we're going to give you a little bit of the same, but it's going to be different. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of structural similarities to the first movie that happened in the second movie. So there's a part of me that really wants to watch 3, but there's also a part of me that doesn't want to show 3 to Amy the same way I will never show her Superman 3, because it's horrible. And as a teenager, I knew it was horrible sitting in the theater where I was just like, wow, this is really bad. But, yeah, I don't know that there's...
It's always a red flag when the sequel happens, you know, 20 years later.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Me.
It's really... It's like, and there's a whole bunch of stuff in there with the Pope, and it's really... Paul, do you even remember? Like, when was the last time you saw Godfather 3?
I saw it in the theater. And
me too!
I haven't since then. I just... It's
heartbreaking.
Do you want to run out screaming?
Well, just the whole thing, you know,
Is it disappointing?
It's just sort of disappointing. It's like, you know, it's like seeing, I don't know, like seeing a band awesome, you know, but, you know, they've reformed, but, you know, hey, they've got a new lead singer and, you know, and they replaced the bass player too. And, you know, and they've got a different guy sitting in on guitar. Really, it's the drummer who's the only one from the original.
They replaced like James Caan with, what's his face from Love at First Bite? Like, you know, Tan.
Yeah.
What's his name?
I'll have to look it up.
Crap.
It's like I said, the only thing I can think of saying is that it sort of reeked of contractual obligation.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Robert Duvall wasn't going to come back. They couldn't meet his quote, you know, and it was just, I remember. Okay. So again, I've said that these movies were like, oh my God, like in New York and New Jersey. It was like, oh my God. And I specifically remember over the Christmas holiday, this movie coming out, and a bunch of my friends from high school, all of us getting ready to go and see The Godfather 3. And this was like, I mean, it's already Christmas. So, like, this was like holiday on top of holiday on top of holiday. And this was like almost like a Phantom Menace level of disappointment. This was just like oh my God, like just sitting there coming out of the theater in the cold, looking at each other like, Jesus Christ, whose body do I dump in the river who's responsible for this?
I love the idea of The Godfather Part 3 being the Phantom Menace for Italians.
It's just like, it is. We're all sitting there looking at each other like, that was really bad, right? You know, we're all teenagers. We love movies. I mean, at that point, you know, I'd become a movie lover. And, you know, we're all kind of like looking at each other like, holy shit, like this is really bad. Like it was an unthinkable thing. Unthinkable. It was impossible. Like, it was impossible that The Godfather 3 would suck. And it did. And it was horrible. It was just terrible. Ooh. So don't do it. Don't do it. Just watch The Godfather 2 and don't cave into the temptation. Because it really is the Superman 3 of The Godfather movies. It's like, holy cow.
What if I like it?
If you like it, you may have to tell me to watch it again. I mean, it has been 20 years. Maybe I could find something to like in it. You know what I mean? But I'm just like, we're very curious. Like, we almost caved into the temptation to be like, oh, maybe we'll watch it. Maybe. And Amy's like, should we watch it? I'm like, I don't think we can watch it. It's just because you're basically watching two masterpiece epics. And then if you watch the third one, it's basically like somebody coming in and crapping all over your nice 5-course meal and just saying, thanks, whatever, farting and leaving. Like, you know, it's just horrible.
Even if it's not that far, it's like, you know, after you've eaten a lovely meal, sometimes you just don't need to eat anymore.
Yeah, exactly. It's really bad. It's really bad.
It's like a TV show that goes on too long.
Yeah. Or that you never needed. It's that reunion show that they never needed, you know, where you were like, oh, they all kind of look old now.
One.
Yeah. It's like they're all
book series or whatever. Anne Rice writes a lot of book series, obviously, and like the vampire ones and the witch ones. And by the fourth one, it's probably like number three for Godfather. Like,
yeah,
it's just like, really? You're just writing this now because somebody contracted you to do it because you don't care, you're not in the characters.
Yeah.
And that happened like three different series with her. Like, oh my God.
Wow.
Do you think I've learned to maybe just stop at the third?
Yeah, that's the thing. That's that. I think The Godfather,
you try to get out, but they keep pulling you back in.
That is a line from Godfather 3. Oh my God. It's like the biggest line in the movie. But then, you know, Coppola does Dracula after that, and you're like, dude, something's wrong. Like, something's wrong with you. Stop. Just stop making movies. Like, you're practically begging him to stop. So anyway, any final thoughts on The Godfather now that we've kind of gone over it a bit for our part-time fanboy film club?
I was thinking about it as, because you kind of asked me about it as a woman watching it or whatever. And I think what I picked up on was the subtlety of the women being sort of to the side, or I don't know if they were, I don't really know that I felt like they were secondary, but they were just kind of, you know, careless and whatever else they said they were. Uh-huh. And I didn't feel like the men were very macho and like, look, we're men and we're men and we're many and we're many and we're still men-like and we still say bad things and men. I didn't get that feeling. Like, you know what
That's
I mean?
Really,
I didn't feel like I was put into a corner or like, why the hell am I watching this? Like, I didn't get any of that feeling.
So you didn't feel like there was some certain like male chest thumping? Because I really feel like being a teenager in New Jersey at the time, you know, there was a lot of, you know, you can't, it's a racist term, Guido. People would call them Guidos, but you would have these dudes, and I think that they're still out there, the Jersey guys who are like lifting weights and wearing tank tops in the winter and like, you know.
Jersey Shore, man.
Yeah, Jersey Shore. It obviously still exists. I'm not trying to offend anybody, but these movies and other movies like them that that Al Pacino and Robert De Niro were in. Like, it's very much like Oliver Stone's Wall Street. You know how, like, that movie is an indictment of Wall Street, but people focused on Gordon Gekko and were like, oh, he's just the greatest. He's the coolest character. Like, he's just amazing. Like, Michael Douglas is amazing. And looking at him as sort of like a weird hero. I feel like the Godfather movies did that for Italian and Latino guys growing up in New Jersey. Where it was like, yeah, hey, what are you doing? I'm a dude. I'm going to beat your head in. Women, fuck them. You know, like, I really feel like. So, like, for you to say
Sunny, like, I think Sunny. But you know, and yeah, okay, there were a bunch of guys being guys, like, and lots of peacock feathers running around, but
yeah,
I know that I really felt like, I don't know, machoed out. I didn't feel like pushed out as a woman watching it, if that makes any sense.
That's great.
There's numerous stories that I've seen where I'm just like, oh, okay, yes, we get it, you're guys.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Corey.
Yeah, I was just gonna say, I think, you know, there's gonna be people who get, you know, just like you said with what was that movie you mentioned? Risky?
Wall Street.
Risky Business.
Yeah, there were people dancing around in their underwear all over.
One of those 80s movies. I don't know. I think there's always gonna be people who, you know, grab onto to, you know, they'll interpret it however they want to interpret it or need to interpret it.
Sure.
And miss kind of the nuance and the critique of it. I mean, you know, people still think Randy Newman's I Love LA is a celebration of Los Angeles and not sarcastic, you know, critique of it. So, you know, it's like, yeah, it's kind of like, I don't think it's, you know, it's hard to critique a movie for what comes after. It's kind of like blaming Watchmen, you know, saying Watchmen's not quite as good because of all the terrible grim and gritty comics that came after it. You know, it's kind
of... Yeah. Which is wrong. Watchmen is excellent, but that's just me. what about you, Paul? Any final thoughts?
Yeah, it's sort of impossible to, like, say, to, like, underrate this movie in a way because it has been so influential on everything that's come since then, you know. And, you know, plus it's just one of the most pretty looking movies ever.
Yeah. I mean, it really, without The Godfather, there's just like basically a whole slew of movies that just don't happen, or at least don't happen the way that they did. Right. I mean, TV shows, there's so much stuff that you could point to and just be like, wow, that comes from The Godfather. And obviously The Godfather comes from other movies, but I think that is the one in the modern era of filmmaking that was just like, bam, this is it, you know, like, done, you know, like Coppola could, like you said, Paul, Coppola could have walked away, never made anything else and still been hailed as a genius. You know what I mean? So great. I mean, I'm glad that we all got a chance to watch it. Well, thanks for doing this, guys. This has been the part-time fanboy film club episode of The Godfather. I've got Corey and Nalin Blake on the line, Paul Edwards, and my name is Christian Horn. Thanks for listening and thanks for being here, guys. It was awesome.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Corey, you got to pick the next movie. Maybe pick something shorter next time.
I'll do a short film.
All right. Well, the ball is in your court, my friend.
All right.
Thanks for doing this, guys. Awesome.
All right. Thank you.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing. I'm doing part-time. Part-timefanboy.com.